Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Mr. Fitzpatrick, you have a motion.
And what I would ask is that when I mention your name, if you could step forward so that the judges who you don't work for know who you are. I'd appreciate it.
Or those who do.
It's my honor and pleasure to be here to move the admission of the law clerks and staff attorneys of the Court of Appeals. The first one is Steve Art, who is a law clerk to Judge Wood. Undergraduate, was at the University of Chicago. His law school degree was from Northwestern, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Darag Badlani is a law clerk to Judge Williams. His undergraduate is at Yale University. His law school was at New York University, and he's admitted to practice in the state of New York. Giselle Burns is a law clerk to Judge Williams. Her undergraduate degree is from the University of Central Florida. Her law school degree is from the University of California at Berkeley, and she's admitted to practice in the state of New York. Frank Dickerson III is a law clerk to Chief Judge Easterbrook. His undergraduate degree is from Claremont McKenna College. His law school degree is from the University of Chicago, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Alexander Samuel Edelson is a law clerk for Judge Flum. His undergraduate and his law school degrees are from the University of Michigan, and he's admitted to practice in the state of New York. Daniel Fine is another law clerk to Judge Flum. His undergraduate degree is from the College of William and Mary. His law school degree is from the University of Chicago, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Christina Gordon is a law clerk to Judge Bauer. Her undergraduate degree is from the Washington University in St. Louis, and her law school degree is from Loyola University here in Chicago, and she's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Linda Janicek is a staff attorney whose undergraduate degree is from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where her law school degree is also from. She's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Stephen Judge is a law clerk to Judge Mannion. His undergraduate degree is from Loyola College in Maryland. His law school degree is from Notre Dame, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Maryland and the District of Columbia. William Catt is a law clerk to Judge Sykes. His undergraduate degree is from Georgia Tech. His law school degree is from Northwestern University, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Michael Klinger is a staff attorney whose undergraduate degree is from Harvard. His law school degree is from the University of Illinois, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Matt Lasher is a law clerk to Judge Caney. His undergraduate degree is from Indiana University, and his law school degree is from Indiana University at Indianapolis. He's admitted to practice in Indiana. Melanie McKay is a law clerk to Judge Bauer. Her undergraduate degree is from Georgetown University. Her law school degree is from DePaul, and she's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Benton Martin is a staff attorney whose undergraduate degree is from Michigan Technological University. His law school degree is from Emory University, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Brian McLeish is a law clerk for Judge Caney. His undergraduate degree is from St. Joseph's College. His law school degree is from the University of Chicago, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Connie Moore Weatherby is a law clerk to Judge Williams, whose undergraduate degree is from Princeton. Her law school degree is from Stanford, and she's admitted to practice in the state of California. Alexandra Lee Newman is a staff attorney whose undergraduate degree was at Yale. Law school degree is from Northwestern, and she's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Christine O'Neill is a staff attorney whose undergraduate degree is from Princeton University, her law school degree from Columbia, and she's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. David Owens is a law clerk to Judge Wood. His undergraduate degree is from the University of Washington. His law school degree is from Stanford, and he's admitted to practice in the state of California. Ryan Parsons is a law clerk to Judge Sykes. His undergraduate degree is from the University of Notre Dame. His law school degree is from Marquette, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Wisconsin. Sarah Rao is a law clerk to Judge Flum. Her undergraduate degree is from Northwestern. Her law school degree is from Harvard, and she's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Nathan Rain is a law clerk to Judge Posner, whose law undergraduate degree is from the University of Chicago. His law school degree is from Columbia, and he's admitted to practice in the state of New York. William Renner is another law clerk to Judge Posner, whose undergraduate degree is from the University of Notre Dame, and his law school degree is from Yale. He's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois and in the District of Columbia. Catherine Rowan is a law clerk to Judge Evans. His undergraduate degree is from Amherst College. Law school degree is from the University of Chicago, and she's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Elena Chagall is a staff attorney whose undergraduate degree is from the University of Illinois in Chicago. Her law school degree is from Harvard, and she's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Logan Steiner is a law clerk for Judge Sykes. Her undergraduate degree is from Pomona College. Her law school degree is from Harvard, and she's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Marissa Van Sonnen is a law clerk to Judge Hamilton, and her undergraduate degree is from Wellesley. She also has a master's in philosophy from Oxford, and her law school degree is from Yale. She's admitted to practice in the state of Maryland. William Wall is a law clerk to Judge Kaney. His undergraduate degree is from Eastern Illinois. His law school degree is from the University of Michigan, and he's admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Stephen Winter is a staff attorney whose undergraduate degree is from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Law school degree is from Washington University and is admitted to practice in the state of Illinois and Virginia. And Karen Zwick is a staff attorney whose undergraduate degree is from the University of Chicago. Law school degree is from Columbia and admitted to practice in the state of Illinois. Your Honors, I move their admission.
Thank you, Mr. Fitzpatrick. Your motion is granted. This is a very well-qualified group. We look forward to the rest of the time that all of you are spending at the court and then to many years of seeing you on the other side of the bar representing your clients.
Or on this side, too.
That may happen in the longer run. So if you will turn in the direction of the clerk's office in order to take the oath. We're ready for argument now in the case of Empress Casino Joliet against the Balmoral Racing Club. Mr. Andelman.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Robert Andelman, and I represent the Empress Casino and the plaintiff's casinos in this case. To borrow from the panel majority decision in this case, all of the money at issue, 100%, is for the racetrack's private benefit, and I would add all of it is in the racetrack's private accounts. None of it, zero, may be used by the state of Illinois to pay for any state expense. The taxes.
What do you call this exaction?
The exaction is a surcharge. It's a condition of licensure, and our position, of course, is that it is more like a fee than a tax.
Well, a fee is something that's collected for a service rendered to the payor. That's not.
Sometimes, Your Honor, but there are cases under the Tax Injunction Act. The Transport Marine case in the First Circuit is an example. The Wright versus Rivlin case in the Ninth Circuit is an example where exactions or surcharges have been deemed not to be taxes, but where no service was provided to the payor.
Yes, but I'm asking you what you want to call that type of
this
exaction.
Court in the,
it's
in
not
the,
a fee, right? A fee is something you pay for a service.
I don't know if I would agree that that's the definition of a fee. The Kathreen panel, which came out 9 days after the panel in our case, would call it a compensation charge, a correction for a negative externality that went to the party that was impacted by it. But I think there's actually something of a danger in getting...
So is a pollution tax in your view or a fee?
Depends on how it's gathered and what it's used for.
So you're not suggesting to us some crisp test for whether an exaction is a tax, but we have to consider a lot of different things? Is that your view?
That's correct. That's the standard that the First Circuit announced in the San Juan Cellular case, and it's the standard that's
followed. It's interesting, of course. That's an opinion by Judge Pryor, and it is multifactorial. But his approach doesn't actually have the support of his colleagues, does it? In the Supreme Court.
I think his approach
a loose test that has no predictive force because judges weigh the different factors differently.
Your Honor, there are lots of examples of cases where courts apply multi-factor cases.
Right, that's true.
And that doesn't, and the Supreme Court...
Sad, but it's true.
I think it's, you know, the problem is... That
but, of course, the more factors you have, the more a judge's attitude toward a particular particular legislation is going to influence the result, right?
Human,
he thinks it's, you know, rent-seeking or a racket or punitive or what have you, then the judge will say, well, I'm going to emphasize this factor, that factor, and decide that it's not...
There's a way around that issue, Your Honor, and that is... whether this is a fee or a tax is one way to approach the application of the Tax Injunction Act. Another way that, in essence, renders that discussion irrelevant is whether or not the injunction or the equitable relief that we seek impacts the revenue-raising capacity of the state.
But why does the label that the state has put on the thing make such a difference to you? Because I take it that if the state of Illinois' General Assembly had passed a statute that said there's going to be a 3% exaction on casinos, which will be paid into the general revenue fund of the state, and then they passed a companion bill that said in an amount equal to the collections from the casinos, there will be a payment to one of our most important industries, the horse racing industry, by funneling it through the general revenue fund, it would be very clear that this is simply a way of raising money. But yet the end result would be exactly the same.
I think the difference here is that the state assumed no obligation.
But sure it did. I mean, the General Assembly used its power to raise a certain amount of money, and it designated that money under an earmark for the horse racing people. But earmarks are very common in tax legislation, and I'm not sure whether your view is that just all earmarks are, in fact, not taxes.
No, I think some earmarks have been held to implicate the TIA, and some haven't. That's not a dispositive factor one way or another.
What's the Social Security tax?
Your Honor, I looked up the $250 benefit that we talked about.
Is Social Security a tax?
Pardon?
Is the Social Security tax a tax in your view?
It is, because the government has adopted a system of fixed benefits.
But it's deposited in a trust fund, right? It's Social Security.
No, it's not. It actually goes in the general
fund. You don't know about the Social Security trust fund?
I remember the debate that Vice President Gore had at the time, when he said the lockbox is a fiction, because, of course, it goes into general revenue, which is the reason why the fund eventually will go bankrupt. But if I take the example we discussed last time of the $250 stimulus package, remember we discussed the oral argument in the panel, I went back and looked at the statute there.
Sir, Posner may remember what you discussed in the panel,
but
the rest of us do not. I suggest you give full answers, not shorthand.
If you get a chance.
Thank you, Your Honor. let me go back to a point I was trying to make before. Whether this is a tax or a fee, it doesn't impact the revenue-raising power of the state of Illinois.
But I think it does, in that if the state of Illinois has a couple of different ways to raise the revenue, it's chosen one way, which means it doesn't have to use another way. It doesn't have to raise the state income tax to give the horse racing industry a benefit. It doesn't have to raise sales taxes in the state of Illinois. It's chosen a method, which is to use this tax. Let me ask you, suppose Illinois decided that with gas prices being as high as they are, it really wants to encourage electric cars. So it says for all vehicles manufactured in the state of Illinois, if there are any, there's going to be a tax if the mileage is below a certain level. And that money is going to be collected and turned over to anybody, universities or others, who are doing research on electric cars. Would you find that not to be a tax?
Your Honor, I think it depends on whether it's simply a pass-through or
why does it depend on that?
The reason it's dependent on it, I go back to the language of this statute.
But I'm trying to find out why, if the state uses its authority to impose an obligation to pay money, and it has a particular destination, and I've deliberately tried to suggest some element of competition between the two entities, the people who manufacture conventional cars and the people who are doing research for electric cars. And the state likes electric cars better, we'll just say. I don't know why that's not an exercise of the state's authority, and it certainly seems that the Illinois Supreme Court thought that this particular exaction that you're talking about was a tax.
They didn't.
They call it a tax throughout their opinion. What are you talking about?
I'm talking about their analysis of the takings issue in that opinion, and they noted the argument that the takings analysis would be different in the context of a fee versus a tax, and they said we don't have to decide that because even applying the analysis applicable to fees, which is ultimately what they did, we reached the same result. The issues before this court about the Tax Injunction Act weren't before the Illinois Supreme Court. They didn't consider it. They applied different standards. And I think the issue we have with this approach of looking at different kinds of subsidy programs is we are afield from the language of the statute that we are seeking to apply.
But you know what
because
about the statute?
Because we're not talking about levy assessment or collection.
But here's the thing that does implicate the statute. According to you, if the state uses this system, the system that they've enacted in the 2006 and 2008 acts, then equitable relief is possible. You've also agreed that if the state funneled it through the general revenue fund, then there would be no possibility of an injunction because the Tax Injunction Act would apply. So you are suggesting that the federal courts should channel state fundraising, state revenue functions in certain directions, which strikes me as quite contrary to the purpose of the Tax Injunction Act.
Your Honor, that's not our position, because the only reason I would think the TIA would apply here is if the state of Illinois had said, we're going to subsidize this industry, the racing industry, to the tune of, say, $10 million a year, and the way we're going to pay for that is this surcharge. Then I think we would have an issue.
Why does that make, I don't understand you. Why does that make a difference? Or put differently, why not have a simple rule which said if it's not a fee, that is a fee for services, if it's not revenue from the sale of government property, and if it's not a fine, then an exaction is a tax, whether it goes into a trust fund, whether it's called a tax, which, of course, legislators don't like to do now. Nowadays, you don't call things taxes, a light word, or whether it's earmarked for a particular industry. Those are just the administrative details. And why isn't the simple approach?
Well, that's
exactly I'm suggesting attractive. Why should we fuss about these details, what it's called? Whether it's a trust fund, whether it's a real trust fund or a fictional trust fund.
Well, the first, the Ninth Circuit in the Vidar case specifically talked about
different... No, give me a big answer based on the... that's a bad case. That's the Apple case. That's like the, you know, San Juan Cellular case. That's a case where they make the industry fund its regulatory program, right? That's a fee. They get a service. They're regulated. They pay a fee for it. That's not this. Obviously, the casinos aren't being rendered any benefit. The money being taken for them for the horses. So why is that different from any other transfer tax?
What the court in that case did was discuss what definition of tax makes sense in this context. It considered the exact definition that you and Judge Wood are talking about, a mandatory exaction for a public purpose, they said. That's the test that's used in the bankruptcy
context. It was to support the regulation of the... It was on the apple growers to support the regulation of apples. I mean, that's, you know, as I say, like the cellular case. Telephone companies... Let me finish. Telephone companies are taxed...
Did you finish your answer to the first question?
Let me finish, will you please?
Well, I thought that you'd let him
finish. All right, forget it.
I think the current status is Judge Posner is asking a question. Please continue.
The reason it is not about a simple definition. Every court that has looked at this issue has said it's a multifaceted test. Now, obviously, this court can go its own direction, but the other circuits have all approved a multifaceted test. They have all looked at whether or not there is a impact on the revenue-raising ability of the state. They've all keyed it to the levy, collection, and assessment of revenue by the state. The reason it's significant that they chose this method is because the state didn't promise the racetracks anything other than whatever the casinos paid in. They didn't assume any obligation. We could have decided, you know what, the state is too corrupt. We're going to shut down and leave. Then they wouldn't have gotten any money because the legislators didn't decide this is something that the state of Illinois was going to take on as an obligation. The Tax Injunction Act, at its core, and the Supreme Court has said this, and the language of the statute bears it out, is concerned with revenue raising, not with how the money gets spent, but with whether the state is going to be stuck with a bill that it can't pay.
I don't think so, actually. I think the Tax Injunction Act is a congressional statement that the federal courts are to stay out of this core governmental function that the states have, which is to decide how, when, and where they're going to raise their money, to whom that money will go. If the states are sovereign in our system, if we have a real federal system, the states need to be given that discretion without a lot of federal oversight saying you can use method A, but we're not going to let you use method B, and C is all right if you put some bells and whistles into it.
Well, the Supreme Court's disagreed. So in Hibbs, they said, Your Honor, the Hibbs court said the TIA does not prohibit interference in the operation of or compliance with state tax laws. That's what the Supreme Court said.
And then Hibbs is followed by Levin, which, as you know, cuts back considerably on some of the language.
It doesn't cut back on that issue. And the majority in Hibbs specifically took issue with the dissent's attempt in that case to say that the Tax Injunction Act draws some big circle around state tax laws. We wouldn't have an Establishment Clause jurisprudence if federal courts couldn't get involved with how states decide to spend their tax money.
I don't think that's the direction you want to go in, given what's happening to Establishment Clause jurisprudence and the number of people who are entitled to raise these claims.
Mr. Andelman, isn't it true that the state of Illinois is indifferent to this litigation?
They are indifferent. In fact, Judge Kennelly invited them to court on November 23rd, a couple days after the injunction was issued, in case they had an issue. And they didn't. And Judge Kennelly specifically found and stated on the record, it's clear the state has no issue here, only the racetracks do.
Has the Tax Injunction Act's jurisdictional bar ever been applied to block jurisdiction in a suit with a state or an instrumentality of the state, an agency, or a local taxing authority has not been a party?
A party or an intervener. The closest there's been is there was a case last year in Alabama that involved private parties, but the private party there had been hired by the municipality to assess, audit, and collect taxes. So they were acting, in essence, as an agent. It's never been applied in this context, ever. This would be the first of its kind. And the other thing I think is significant, and it's probably why the state didn't have any issue here, is this money never really belongs to the state. It's in a trust fund. The state is the trustee. The beneficiaries of the trust are the racetracks. So other than in a trustee capacity, this case doesn't involve state revenues. And if you look at...
So why are you even bothering to pay it?
We bother to pay it because it's a condition of our license, because we're a regulated
entity. So in other words, because the state
has
some authority to require you to pay this money.
They can only force us to pay it if we seek a license under its regulatory power.
Of course, that's right. But that's true of every tax. You know, if Sears decides to move away from Hoffman Estates to North Dakota, then it won't be paying any taxes to Illinois anymore. I mean, that's just a truism.
I think there's a distinction between money you pay in order to get a license as a regulated industry and money you pay as a business operating in the state, which is applicable generally to all businesses that operate in the state.
And why is that a difference? Why is that relevant to anything?
Because it's a condition of licensure. There are taxes in the Illinois Gaming Act, but they're in a different part of the statute altogether. This is a police power issue. This isn't about the tax. This doesn't even derive from the taxing power.
Why does that make a difference that it's a police power issue if it generates much more than any regulatory fee would if it really produces revenue?
It doesn't produce revenue for the state because the state is just a trustee. It only produces revenue for these private parties.
But you're assuming the state doesn't have any other areas where it's singled out particular industries for largesse, and that's just not true.
Well, we looked up each of the it certainly is true that there is no example where an industry is required to put money into a trust fund, which within days must be transferred to another industry for its operating expenses. There's no other example like that. The three statutes that were cited in Judge Posner's dissent, one, it was a general tax of 30 cents a bottle on wine, one of which went to fund the creation of a board, which was an obligation Ohio adopted. One funds the Illinois Clean Technology Board, another state agency that's being, in essence, funded by that exaction. And one involves setting up a claim for royalties for, to resolve royalty claims by folks who didn't, the money is funded from digital media importers to fund royalty claims by others.
You're into your rebuttal time, you know.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll sit down and reserve. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Andelman. Mr. Traylor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Constantine Trella, I represent Arlington Park Racecourse, and I'm speaking this morning on behalf of Hawthorne and Fairmont as well. Your Honors, the casino surcharge is a tax. It's a measure designed to raise revenue to be used to advance a public purpose and serve the general welfare. It is not intended to cover the cost of regulatory activity or any service provided to the payors. It's not a means of regulating the casinos. It doesn't pay for any service provided to them. It is not a fee. It's a tax for Tax Injunction Act purposes. Now, I'd like to address one comment that Mr. Andelman made right at the outset. He said that the Illinois Supreme Court did not address the question of whether this was a tax. Not only did the court repeatedly refer to it as a tax, but in disposing of the casino's takings claim, the court said, quote, and this is at 896 Northeast 2nd, 293, that the measure did not involve the state's exercise of its eminent domain power, but rather involves the exercise of its taxing powers. So if it matters under which constitutional provision the state adopts a measure, the Illinois Supreme Court has definitively resolved that question. It was a taxing measure.
That's not really true. The court variously in that opinion referred to this as a tax and as a fee and mostly referred to it as a surcharge and was not consistent in its characterization of this law and was addressing only state constitutional challenges and the takings clause challenge. It really doesn't have anything to do with this case.
Well, I disagree that it has nothing to do with this case, Your Honor. The way that a state court characterizes the operation of a statute, the purpose of a statute, those are matters of state law. I understand that the question of whether it's a tax for purposes of the act is a federal question.
Right.
But
and
you
the,
can't
the
ignore
state
what
Supreme
the state has said the purpose of a statute is or the way the statute operates.
The state Supreme Court did not construe the statute. It simply turned away constitutional challenges to it under what are essentially extremely weak limits on the state legislature's power.
I don't think that's right, Your Honor. The court most definitely did construe the statute.
There was no question of statutory construction in that case.
There was a question of statutory construction because the casinos argued that it was a takings for a purely private purpose. It didn't serve any public
purpose. That didn't require the state to construe the statute, in other words, to say what it means. There was no dispute about what the statute means, and there's no dispute here about what the statute means. That case was a state constitutional challenge. This is a racketeering case. The two are very different.
Well, I understand that the cases are different, Your Honor, but I respectfully disagree with your assessment of the Illinois Supreme Court's opinion. The court clearly held that this was an exercise of the state's taxing power. I would also add that where the state powers are concerned, as distinct from municipalities, it ultimately doesn't matter because the Illinois Supreme Court has held in the case of Sherman Reynolds versus Mahan that the state can tax under its police power because when it adopts police power measures, it needs to finance them. And so of course, there's taxing power under that part of the Constitution as well. So if it matters for Tax Injunction Act purposes, that state law question has been definitively resolved. Now, Mr. Andelman referred to the multifacet or multifactor test that the courts of appeals have used, and that's certainly true. And there are some differences, and you can find cases that you would think would be on one side of the line and end up on another. But the principle that emerges from the cases is really pretty close, I think, to a clear test, and that is that a charge that's designed to raise revenue to provide services or benefits to the public is a tax for purposes of the Tax Injunction Act, and a charge that's designed to pay for benefits provided to the payor or for regulation is a fee and not a tax for purposes of the Tax Injunction Act. All the various criteria that the courts of appeals have used over the years, such as did the legislature impose it or did an agency and did it go into a special fund or the general fund, all of those are just tools to arrive at that ultimate question. Another critical guide, and this I know that Judge Sykes disagrees with me on this, but it's what the state says the purpose is, not whether it calls it a tax or a fee, because that's ultimately the federal question, but whether either in the enactment itself or otherwise the state has made clear whether the charge is imposed to recover specific costs that the payors are in some way imposing on the state government, or on the other hand, to provide more broad benefits to the general public and to serve the general welfare. If it's the latter, it's a tax and it's covered by the Act.
So is there some third category, though? Because I think what bothered the panel was the notion that the state, which certainly has the authority to create license fee, to require people to pay money, I'll say, without labeling, has decided rather openly to say, A, namely the casinos, have to pay money to support private entities, B, the horse racing people. And the question is whether that's the kind of thing that is capable of being addressed through the equitable powers of the federal court when it doesn't look anything like, you know, repairing the roads, it doesn't look anything like supporting the schools, it doesn't look anything like giving old age compensation to people. It's just a very direct transfer.
A couple of responses. Judge Sykes.
I'm Judge Wood. She's down at the other end. I know we look alike, right?
I think at one level your question goes to really questioning the public purpose and whether this is proper business of government. Supporting an important industry is a core function of government. Sure, roads are important, are obviously a governmental function, as are schools and the other things you mentioned, but so is supporting a local industry that in this case employs over 37,000 people. So at that level, I think it clearly meets the criteria to be a tax. The other level of your question, I think, has to do really with the mechanism that the state chose to implement this public purpose. I don't think that anybody would say, if the state had created the Horse Track Racing Rescue Commission and had taken this surcharge money, given it to this commission, and then the commission doled it out, that shouldn't make any difference. Here, basically, the state has said, okay, we don't need to create that bureaucracy. We're going to transfer this money to the racetracks under strict control, 60% for purses, 40% for track improvements and other operations, and will serve the same function. So I think for both of those reasons, I think although it's you know, it doesn't look like the income tax, for example. It's very much a tax. It's an exaction to serve public purposes, and it's clearly not a fee in the cost recovery sense.
That argument is essentially any time the public purpose doctrine of the state constitution is satisfied, that's the end of the matter, and the Tax Injunction Act bars any federal litigation that implicates that the operation of that law. That can't possibly be the rule for Tax Injunction Act purposes if, as you say, and I think you must concede, that this is a federal question governed by the meaning of the Tax Injunction Act as it's been interpreted by the Supreme Court.
Whether it's a tax for purposes of the Act clearly is a federal question.
Right. So the fact that the law that's at issue serves a public purpose, whether directly or incidentally, and satisfies the state constitutional public purpose doctrine really doesn't matter.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, it does matter. How can a federal court, is a federal court going to decide that horse racing is important in Kentucky but not in
That's
Illinois?
That's not the point here. We're not talking about the merits of this law. We're talking about whether it was procured by bribery and corruption. That's the issue here. The state is indifferent to this case. It was offered an opportunity to object to the constructive trust. It did not. That silence is deafening.
Your Honor, the issue before this court is not whether this statute was procured by bribery or corruption.
That's the issue in the litigation.
And
right.
That should not make any difference to whether this is a tax
right.
or isn't a tax.
My point is that the merits of the law are not on the table. What's on the table is how to characterize it for purposes of the Tax Injunction Act.
The purpose of the law, however, is on the table. I think it has to be on the table to apply the Tax Injunction Act.
And you still have the distinction between fee and right. tax. I mean, it's not like everything is a tax. There are fees, but this doesn't happen to fund anything for the casinos.
Yeah, this is clearly not a fee. The casinos aren't getting anything. This does not pay for regulation of the casinos. So if the distinction is tax versus fee, this is clearly a tax. The other thing I'd like to address is the notion that the state doesn't care about this law. Now, the state did not intervene here. However, where the state has been named as a party, specifically in the state court litigation, it has vigorously defended these statutes and is continuing to do so.
As a constitutional matter, which makes sense, the state had an opportunity to intervene here to protect this trust fund and did not.
That's true.
Now, is there any reason to think perhaps that the state thought that the horse racing parties were going to defend it adequately on their own?
Well, clearly the horse racing parties were interested in defending it adequately on their own, and at least in the district court, were able to do so. I'd be speculating if I tried to guess why the state didn't appear here. Could be budgetary.
Well, because the state is broke, that's one reason.
Well, for
economizing its legal expenses.
They may not be looking for places to devote their resources.
Speaking of which, Mr. Trella, as I understand Judge Kennelly's findings, the case comes to us so that we have to assume that this was an utterly corrupt bargain between Governor Blagojevich and some of the horse track interests here. Is there any reason now why the state could not, and the new administration could not, decide to abandon this corrupt bargain and decide that this $100 million or so would be better directed, let's say, for schools or universities or public health, repudiate the statutes through new legislation, and use this money now for general public purposes, since, of course, it is a tax, as you say?
In the abstract, Your Honor, I can't think of any reason why, but I have to confess I haven't studied the Illinois constitutional implications of that. I don't know whether there might be some.
You don't think you've
reason.
Got a vested right? Your clients don't have a vested right at this point.
No, we wouldn't have that kind of an argument.
It's state money under your theory.
That's exactly right. It is state money.
Wasn't this trust extended for just 3 years?
Yes, through the end of this year, Your Honor.
Yeah, so it's going to expire by its own terms unless it's renewed.
That's correct, Your Honor. But with the money, at least at the moment, not being devoted to the purposes for which it was extracted, but essentially sitting in escrow. Mr. Andelman, I think, also mentioned the fact that the money went into this separate fund. Well, many cases have held that it doesn't matter whether money goes into a separate fund. What matters is the ultimate purpose to which the money is put. Another element of the tax versus fee debate, and it's It doesn't really fit into either category, but I think the cases are pretty clear that it's not a tax for Tax Injunction Act purposes, and that's a penalty where the state prohibits particular conduct or requires particular conduct. The person doesn't do it, and they get the state penalizes them, imposes a monetary penalty. And the reasoning there is that it's clearly not the state's purpose in those, in those instances, to raise revenue. What the state wants is they want compliance with their rules. And as I think this court noted in the RTC commercial properties case, really the state's objective is to raise zero revenue in those situations because it wants compliance. But beyond the penalty example, I think that the fee versus tax analysis provides a relatively clear test. I'm sure there are cases at the margins that would run into trouble, but I think it will answer most of the cases, most cases that will come before the federal courts. And I think, as I said at the outset, that when you work your way through the multi-factor tests that the various courts of appeals have applied, that's essentially the way the cases fall out, although through a somewhat different
mechanism. Well, I think the marginal case, like the San Juan cellular telephone case and our Schneider Transport, is where you have a fee imposed on an industry to, you know, pay for its regulator, but it generates additional revenue. It both pays for the regulatory expense, but it also is leakage into the general revenues of the state. That is given the courts.
Right, and in fact, in the San Juan case, I think the argument there had been made, that argument had been raised because I believe the statute there provided that if after 5 years the money hadn't been used to fund this agency, then it would go into general revenue. And the court there said, well, if we had some reason to think that there would be a lot left over, then maybe we'd rethink our analysis. So, but on the other hand, of course, the courts that apply the fee analysis don't require an exact matching, and exact matching isn't possible. But you're really looking, I think, to the state's purpose in raising the money. And if the purpose is to pay for the fee, to pay for the services or the regulation, then it's a fee. It's not a tax. But otherwise, it is a tax for Tax Injunction Act purposes.
Well, that binary approach doesn't account for the universe of endlessly creative state and local, not to say federal, laws that take money from people.
How
can we just say if it's not a tax, it's a fee, if it's not a fee, it's a tax, and leave it at that? That kind of bright line rule doesn't work.
Well, Your Honor, I certainly would not minimize the creativity of governments trying to extract money from their citizens. But I think
why we need a multi-factor test, notwithstanding that we don't like those very often.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sitting in your position, obviously, so I don't know what's doable from a judicial perspective. But I think the problem with the multi-factor tests and the way they've been applied is that ultimately a lot of the cases do seem to come down to a judge's feeling about whether the purpose that the state is offering is sufficiently important or somehow sufficiently central to the function of the state government. And when you're dealing with a statute, the Tax Injunction Act, the very purpose of which, as the Supreme Court has said, is to protect principles of federalism, that kind of inquiry into that psychoanalysis of the state, or that second guessing of what the state has said its purpose is, just does not seem like the appropriate way to apply a statute with that purpose. I see that I'm into somebody's rebuttal time, so I will. If the Court has no further questions, I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Trella. Mr. McKenna.
May it please the Court, William McKenna on behalf of both Balmoral and Maywood Racetracks. Tax Injunction Act is really based on the same underlying principles of federalism as the comity doctrine as articulated in Levin and Fletcher versus Peck from Chief Justice Marshall. I think it demonstrates a wariness on the part of federal judicial involvement in the inner workings of state government generally, but particularly with respect to its fiscal affairs. Its efforts to make raise revenue, exactions, and exactly how and who you exact funds from to accomplish some sort of public purpose. And Fletcher in particular tells us way back in 1810 that inquiry into the subjective motives, in that case bribery, of an entire legislature to give a land grant is forbidden in terms of assessing the constitutionality of a statute. And in that case, in Fletcher, I think Judge Hamilton's comment about couldn't the legislature here just reverse field and pass a new statute? No question. Could repeal the statute? No question. But in Fletcher, the Georgia legislature pretty much voted out those who were accused of bribery and created a new statute. But because there had been intervening purchasers of the land who were BFPs, the Supreme Court decided that statute could not be invalidated because of the allegations of bribery. And I think the federalism that's inherent in Fletcher goes along with the federalism as represented by the TIA, where the TIA tells us that the federal court should not intervene in that, what the case is called, quintessential state function of levying, assessing, or collecting taxes. And here we have that. We have a collection still going on. It's about to end, as Judge Posner noted. The statute sunsets in December of this year, and it could even sunset in June of this year, because the statute provides that this particular exaction ceases if a 10th riverboat license becomes active. So it's coming to an end pretty quickly, but essentially this case seeks to recover the full amount, every dollar of the exaction, through an equitable remedy, constructive trust. And I think there's a number of cases that say you can't do that either. So I guess I return to those principles of federalism.
What are those cases? I thought this is a very unusual posture where the state is not.
The landfill, Your Honor, is one where the court considered a refund action.
The state was not a party, or the taxing authority was not a party in that case?
I believe they were. I believe they intervened.
That's the point. Your argument is undercut by the fact that the state is not a party here.
Well,
the taxing authority is not a party here.
I didn't want to address
they
that,
haven't
Your Honor.
Come up at that kind
I
of.
I did want to address that, Your Honor, because the state is really not indifferent to what happens in this case.
So far as the record is concerned, it is.
Well, but, Your Honor, here's what the state has done so far. They have passed the statute in 2006 with 110 legislative votes. Then, upon constitutional challenge by the riverboats, they vigorously defended it. The tracks were by no means amici in that case. We were parties. We intervened at the outset. Arlington came later. We argued side by side with the Attorney General in the state court. I argued in the Illinois Supreme Court.
This whole procedural history that you are embarking upon occurred before the corruption allegations were made public.
But more occurred after it, Your Honor, because when the Illinois Supreme Court ruled in favor of the constitutionality of the statute, petitions for certiorari were filed by the riverboats. There were a large number of amici who filed in support of certiorari. And in those amici petitions, you will find extensive arguments about alleged corruption. Because by the time we were on appeal, or we were seeking on the cert phase to the Supreme Court, Governor Blagojevich had been arrested.
And those allegations had nothing to do with the state constitutional challenges or the takings claim.
But they form the basis
of this lawsuit, and the constructive trust is sought to prevent the unjust enrichments of your clients based on the RICO conspiracy. The two are just completely separate, and we can't draw any inferences about the state's interest in this litigation from the course of conduct in the constitutional case.
With due respect, Your Honor, in addition to vigorously contesting the cert petition in the Supreme Court, which raised those issues, we came back down. There was a 214-01 petition filed in state court, squarely raised these issues of corruption and bribery. And again, the state stood at my side in the circuit court in Will County and argued Fletcher versus Peck with me, along with other
again,
things.
Again, on state constitutional doctrine grounds, it was very, very different.
And then, Your Honor,
the state had an opportunity in this case to object to the imposition of a public trust, and it did not. That sort of ends the matter as far as the state's interest is concerned.
And then, Your Honor, the 2008 Act was passed, which reenacted and extended this statute. Another lawsuit was filed by the casino boats in the state court, and in that lawsuit there was a count which specifically sought the invalidation, I grant it, on constitutional grounds, of the statute specifically based on corruption and bribery. Again, the state stood at my side in the circuit court of Will County, argued Fletcher versus Peck to have that defeated, among other things. That case went up on appeal to the Third District Appellate Court, and in January of this year, Just before this court's panel opinion came out, again, the state stood at my side and argued vigorously to the appellate court that the constitutionality of the statute was not infirm. So,
and this is not an attack on the constitutionality. The constructive trust has nothing to do with the constitutionality of the two racing acts.
I really do think it does, Your Honor, because in the state court system, particularly in the 2008 action, they specifically challenged the law on grounds of corruption, on grounds of this alleged corrupt bargain, which, of course, we deny. But in that court system, they said this statute can't stand on constitutional grounds because of that. Now, Fletcher versus Peck, which was a damages case in which one party sued another under warranties and a deed, sought to recover damages because of the alleged bribery that invalidated and made ineffective or corrupt a statute. And the Supreme Court said, no, we can't do that. And I think that coming back to our case, the inquiry that if the panel opinion is affirmed and that we're going to undertake when we go back down is over 100 legislators are going to potentially be asked under oath, why did you vote for this statute?
That's a merits question.
That doesn't go to the question of the Tax Injunction Act. But I think the court should be aware of where we're going. Now, one other point I did want to raise, which is this statute is not in any way unprecedented, either in Illinois, in terms of horse racing, or in terms of other states. First of all, in terms of Illinois, there's the Supreme Court's decision in Aringold. In Aringold, a tax was imposed on the producers of smokeless tobacco, put into a trust fund for the benefit of nursing homes. Constitutional case, Uniformity Act case, but nonetheless totally affirmed by the court, no issue with respect to the type of tax it was.
Counsel, you're just barking up the wrong tree on this whole argument. The constitutional doctrines in the Aringold case and in the Janulius case are, as I said earlier, extremely weak limits on the General Assembly's otherwise plenary power. It just really doesn't have anything to say about whether this is a tax under the Tax Injunction Act.
Well, I understand Your Honor's position, but I do think that corruption was raised, and the state was there, and the state's not indifferent.
Well, but whether there's corruption is a different question from whether it's a tax. I mean, you could pass an income tax because you bribed all of the legislators to raise the income tax, and it would still be a tax. So I don't think that the corruption issue has much to do one way or the other with whether it's a tax. If it's a tax, then the Tax Injunction Act says, however seamy we may think the underlying arrangement is in Illinois, the federal courts stay out. Now, obviously, there's still political solutions. There may be solutions in the Illinois courts on various other theories, but I see these as two rather separate issues.
I agree. And I would just add, in terms of the nature of the statute, that the actual Gaming Act in Section 13C5 has a predecessor to this statute that's almost identical. It's a 15% exaction on the holder of the 10th Riverboat license that attempted to relocate to Rosemont and now is about to open in Des Plaines. That was going to go into the Horse Racing Equity Fund. That was going to be distributed to the racetrack. So there is definitely precedent here. Unless the court has further questions, I will cede the balance of my time.
Thank you. Mr. McKenna? Anything further, Mr. Edelman?
Yes, thank you. I'd like to first address a point that Judge Hamilton made. Judge, the state of Illinois can't change its mind and spend this money for something else.
Why not?
Because it's in their private bank accounts. The state doesn't have it. That's the issue. What the injunction that's in place in this case, the state is done with this. They collected the fee. They held it in the trust fund for a period of time. It's now been distributed, and it's held in individual bank accounts owned by these racetracks.
You just heard them say
that. Money every day.
And within days, it all has to be transferred.
Well, the 10 days. But anything that's still in the 10-day fund could be diverted.
But some $130 million, the bulk of the money at this point.
You just heard their counsel say there's no vested right to that money.
But that's untrue, Your Honor.
Surely you don't want to concede they have a vested right to that money at this point.
Well, they have possession of it right now.
Yes, they have
the
possession.
State has no right to
possession
that
of it that the state could decide was the result of this corrupt bargain that you've alleged and convinced Judge Kennelly about.
Why would the state have any less right to reclaim possession of those funds than it had to claim the 3% from the casinos to begin with. The money began in private hands, and the state says we have a valid statute that requires you to give it to us. Why can't it do the same thing with these monies?
Because with us, it was a lever for our license. They don't have a lever to get the money back from them. It's gone.
I think they'd probably call it the taxing power.
They'd have to, the legislature, the General Assembly would have to pass a statute.
How would that be any different from the power you're asking a court, either, whether it's a federal court or a state court, ultimately, to say that there's a that this money is not rightfully the horse racing industry's money and we want it back?
What we're doing is no different than in any case in which you seek to prevent a party from being unjustly enriched by misconduct. You know,
but your unjust enrichment theory really rests on the fact that the state has no power to redistribute among private parties. And that's a very broad assertion. It really is not consistent with the entire history of state taxation and earmarks.
Well, this case is not about earmarks. This case is about
state revenue. Yes, it is. It's earmarked for the horse racing industry.
It's not, because the state never...
Well, who's it earmarked for if not the horse racing industry? It's not yours anymore. They're not giving it to the schools.
Is when the state raises revenue for a state purpose. Here, the
Why
state
is
raises
it not
a
state purpose to encourage a particular industry? In Texas, they encourage the oil and gas industry. Maybe
not
in
like
Kentucky.
Not by paying their operating expenses.
Oh.
This statute is not
I wouldn't go too far out on that limb.
Well, no.
How does the state subsidize the movie producers?
I'm not, Your Honor.
It's extremely common for states to provide subsidies to attract, you know, movie people.
It is not common, and certainly we
Would your case be different, or would your position be different if this money had, instead of being earmarked for horse racing, had been earmarked for poor children in Illinois? Would that change it?
I would ask the court to look at the.
No, answer my question. Would that change your?
No. I would look at the Transport Marine case in which the First Circuit or the Ninth Circuit.
I'm just asking a question whether.
I could answer.
I'm just. That's not my question. My question is whether it makes any difference to. I think you said no. That the destination of the money is a broader group than the horse industry, such as all poor children in Illinois. And you say that makes no difference.
The only issue
which
is that
fine.
Is important from our analysis is does this impact the state's ability to pay an obligation that the state has? Because that's the animating purpose of the Tax Injunction Act.
But that's the only thing you're concerned with.
That's the only thing. The
Not whether it's called a tax or whether it's in a trust fund. Or
that's the tax or fee issue, which certainly is one way to analyze it. Another way to analyze this issue.
I'm not sure now what the implication of this argument is. Many state and local governments will have taxes that are put into a fund, a segregated fund for general relief for people who aren't adequately supported by a welfare program. And this may even be stated as so many mills per dollar on a real estate tax bill. Is it your view that that is not a tax because it goes into a segregated fund, not for an obligation of the state, but because the state simply thinks transfer payment for the very poorest is worthwhile?
Judge Easterbrook, that's the issue that I was trying to get at in this Transport Marine case. In that case, the
I'm not really interested in that. I'm not really interested in that case. I'm interested in my question in particular.
It's the same facts. Yet the answer
No, I was trying to be very careful. Maybe I wasn't careful enough. The general relief funds, as I understand them, are not legal obligations of the state. The state or local government will try to collect money, and it will then say, we will use whatever money we collect, we'll use it constructively for very poor people. But there's no legal entitlement of the poor to any funds out of the general relief fund. So I'm trying to construct a situation in which there's no entitlement to the money on any side, but the state is raising money to create a fund. And I'm trying to figure out whether, in your view, that's a tax.
In my view, the Tax Injunction Act would not apply to that situation.
Okay.
And the only reason I reference that case is because that's exactly the situation they address in that. And they just say the tax injunction, it's a victim compensation fund. And in that case,
this program
is a social welfare program. That's what they conclude, that this fee is being imposed to fund a social welfare program. and they nonetheless say the Tax Injunction Act doesn't apply because the state's obligations aren't at issue. And I think you have to go back to the purposes and the language of this statute. This statute was passed because out-of-state railroads were holding up tax payments and using diversity jurisdiction to bring injunction suits. States were settling those suits for far less than what they were owed. It was risking insolvency of those states, and they passed this statute specifically to prevent
but
those.
But you're not arguing that it's limited to railroads, surely. The Supreme Court has said we should go beyond the Act and apply it even to declaratory judgment suits, for example.
The attitude
that we're supposed to be applying, our superiors, is not to make the law the least it can possibly be worth, but to implement a system of federalism.
Well, this statute is not a statute to implement federalism. This statute.
But the Supreme Court has said it is.
It hasn't. In fact, as I said before, the Supreme Court in Hibbs went out of its way to say it doesn't prevent interference with
the
tax system.
It made it pretty clear that the TIA is a matter.
It's in the context of talking about comedy, they talked about federalism. In the context of talking about the Tax Injunction Act, it's a remedial statute. It's designed to do one thing, which is to avoid
if the state of Illinois, these 110 legislators, if they really want, you know, horses are popular in Illinois, if they want to support the horse industry and racetracks and famous racehorses and so on, they don't like casinos, then if you win this case, then there'll be, you know, pressure in the legislature to create an equivalent or transfer of money from casinos to horse.
I don't think there will be, because down the hall.
No. I'm not talking about an actual prediction of how the legislature would react. We can't do that, obviously. But if there is a program that the state is funding through this device and has loads of alternatives, including a direct tax, called a tax, and so on casinos to pay, then you would be complicating the legislature's life, right? Because there's always an alternative that is a tax that they can employ.
They wouldn't. There is, I think, zero chance the legislature would have assumed an obligation on the part of the state of Illinois to pay these folks operating expenses.
Why?
Because they wouldn't even agree to do this subsidy the first several times it was presented until Mr. Johnson agreed to pay money to get it passed, and now we've got a trial going on down the hall on that very issue.
Doesn't the Indiana law work pretty much the same way, taking money from its riverboats and giving it to the...
It doesn't. Really, what makes this statute so unique is that the money is in a trust fund in which the state is only in a trustee capacity for the benefit of the racetracks.
Doesn't Indiana go to a city, East Chicago?
I can't answer that. I don't know.
There's a problem there, too, because they were unsupervised. The money that went to the fund was unsupervised.
But ultimately, I think some of these are merits issues, because the issue here is there an impact on the state of Illinois' ability to raise revenue for itself?
I'm getting more and more worried by this line of argument. Think about another thing that I would have supposed was a tax, the federal gasoline tax. There's a tax of X cents per gallon of gasoline. It's put into a trust fund, and it's to be used only for road building and road repairs. How many roads are built and how much is spent on repairs depends only on how much gets into the fund, nothing else. And everything in the fund is spent for that purpose. If a state passes the same kind of statute to fund road building or road repairs in the state, in your view, is it a tax or not?
My view, that does not, that would implicate the Tax Injunction Act, and here's why.
Even though there's no obligation, no one is entitled to any road repairs.
Well, but the state has an obligation to maintain safe roads.
It does.
No, it doesn't.
No,
where'd
it doesn't.
Where did you get that from? Where
if it has that obligation, Illinois is wildly out of compliance.
the state does. But the truth is, the General Assembly does because it has to assign funds for road building. And when it does that, it assumes
an obligation. It doesn't have to build roads.
But it doesn't have to, but it did. But they do.
It did this also. It gave money to the horse people. Right?
That is a traditional governmental function. That is a traditional government function.
But that's the problem. You see,
your
multi-factor test is exploding because now we're talking about traditional government functions versus untraditional.
No, we're talking about these are the obligations of the state.
Traditional government function is now a component of your multi-factor test.
Well, the language
isn't
no.
it?
I think we have your position, counsel. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.
Okay, Frank.
You've decided to simplify this.